is an era of crisis. Climate change, the cost of living, the erosion of democracy, and the spread of war. While the Tories have fueled these crises, the Labour Party is failing to provide an alternative. The right has regained control of Labour. Jeremy Corbyn and his politics that inspired millions across our society have been cast out. Labour now opposes strikes for fair pay, rejects public ownership, refuses to defend refugees, and has abandoned plans to scrap tuition fees. Those who support left-wing politics are being denied a political voice. We need a new political party that offers a real solution. One that challenges the system at the root of every crisis we face. To challenge the super rich and the corporations who continue to exploit us and our planet. To fight for our future together. In our workplaces, in our communities, and on the streets. To tear down the political establishment and build a world where we can thrive. We can't rely on our current crop of politicians to do this. We need to do it ourselves. Political parties, organisations and individuals from across the movement have united to take the next step, founding a new party of the left to provide a real alternative to our broken political system. The question is, are you with us?
All right, welcome back to The Popular Show with me, James A. Smith. If you want an independent radical media, please consider supporting us at patreon.com/thepopularpod. I'm with Jackson Keynes. He's joining us from Transform Politics. We've just heard their self-introduction video at the head of the show. Jackson, welcome. Thanks for making some time for us today.
Thanks so much for having me, James.
So you want a new party of the left in Britain. Transform Politics is not that yet. What are you, though?
Hopefully it will be a party. Right now we're at the stage where it's a project of a number of groups and individuals coming together and making this public call, you know, in the form of the video that we've just seen and the text that's on our website, setting out why we think now is the moment that Britain needs a new political party. We're deliberately going through this sort of democratic participatory process to get the party set up. We think that's more engaging than just sort of forming a party immediately and saying, here, take it or leave it. We think there's a need for a party with a real democratic ethos, participatory spirit, and hopefully this sort of formation process will embody that.
You speak about parties taking a kind of take it or leave it approach. We've already had a few since the end of Corbyn attempts that approach, and some of them are involved in your milieu. Could you talk us through the organisations and existing parties that are feeding into this Transform Politics project?
Yeah, of course. So one of them is the Breakthrough Party. I'm a member of the Breakthrough Party. I've been a member of the Breakthrough Party for a couple of years. There's also Left Unity, Liverpool Community Independence, which, as the name suggests, is a local group in Liverpool who people may be aware have had sort of some electoral success there with council seats. And there's the People's Alliance of the Left, which is a slightly looser coalition of people from across the movement who've been working together since 2020 or so.
Most of the listeners to this show and people considering getting involved with you will know the answer to this, but just so that we've got it on tape. The previous leader of the Labour Party was a radical socialist who believes all the things that you believe, and in 2017 managed to get 40% of the vote in Britain. What's wrong with the Labour Party? Okay, we don't like Keir Starmer, but why can't we just take over the Labour Party again, run an election, and potentially do better than we did last time round? Why do we need to start from scratch, Jackson?
Well, we tried taking over the Labour Party. We had one shot. We came very close to to taking it over properly, and we had a shot at state power. But I think we were acting within a historical window, which has closed. I personally think it was something of a historical fluke that the left got the opportunity to take the leadership of the Labour Party. I think the left was so weak, or was considered to be so weak around 2015, that the right of the party were complacent enough or sentimental enough to give Jeremy Corbyn a shot, you know, in the leadership ballot in 2015. They will never make the same mistake again. They will never be so foolish as to let the left come anywhere near power in the Labour Party. Their whole mission now, it seems, that, you know, the thing that makes them get out of bed in the morning is to stop the left coming anywhere near power. So unfortunately, I think that that moment has closed. The right have complete secure control over the Labour Party. So I think we need to try something different.
I'm getting the stupid questions out of the way, as you could tell. Some people will say, okay, Keir Starmer isn't your dream prime minister, but the Tories are in, they've been in for ages, they're terrible, they're wrecking the country. When Corbyn was in charge, you were asking people who maybe didn't love him to nonetheless vote Labour in order to get rid of Theresa May, get rid of Boris Johnson. Why aren't you doing that for Keir Starmer now? Why are you trying to create this party that's going to be running against Labour, potentially splitting the vote in key constituencies, potentially preventing a Labour government? Why are you doing that?
Well, they're fundamentally different scenarios. Corbyn was actually offering people a progressive platform that had policies that might have gone some way to actually addressing the massive problems we have in this country. Keir Starmer's not doing that. He's got a completely different political project. His project seems to be a sort of restoration to politics as normal, or, you know, as it was before the sort of disruptive populist sort of moments that we had around 2015. And he's not really proposing anything that will meaningfully make things better in this country. He seems to mainly make policies that will, you know, pacify the right-wing media or business interests. And if he was moving incrementally in the right direction, you know, I would be, you know, I would consider the argument that you have to hold your nose and vote for Labour. But, you know, he's fundamentally offering something that I, you know, disagree with, that I oppose, and I know that lots of other people oppose.
I would only add to that that it's not only that Keir Starmer is worse than Jeremy Corbyn would have been, or is, you know, ideologically different to the left, and therefore we need to have our own kind of separate base. This isn't a kind of way of advocating a vote for the Tories, but there are specific ways in which there's every reason to think that Keir Starmer could do bad things that the Tories aren't in a position to do. Any historian of New Labour will tell you that the marketisation agenda, the internal decimation of the welfare state was brought forward massively by New Labour. They might have been putting more money into public services, but they were also selling them off by the back door while they were doing so. That's before we get to the respect in which Tony Blair brought Britain into a far more ambitious project of world building that turned out to be a project of world demolition with the Iraq War. Compare that to John Major's much more cautious approach to the previous Gulf War. When you look at Starmer's record in the Crown Prosecution Service, when you look at his record working with the Obama administration and various invisible arms of the British state, you're looking at a man who's far more integrated into the British establishment and the Atlanticist agenda than Rishi Sunak is. So there are all kinds of ways in which we should be very worried about what Keir Starmer is going to be like as Prime Minister. And if we can't stop him being Prime Minister, or if not enough people in our coalition want to stop him becoming Prime Minister, we should at least be acting now to ensure that there is clear blue water between what we are and what he does. That blue water is completely missing in America, where Bernie supporters, Bernie himself, leftists, all charged behind Biden, all joined in with this kind of great blackmail. You've got to stop Trump, forget about your own principles, defend Biden, stop Trump. And now there isn't an American left. There is no way in which they can meaningfully distinguish themselves from the Joe Biden agenda. Do you look at any other experiences of lefts abroad or events in recent British history as a warning? And are you do you see this Transform Politics project as a kind of way of not making mistakes that others have?
Well, firstly, James, I just want to say, you know, I think your summary of who Keir Starmer is and what he represents is completely accurate. And with an analysis like that, you should probably join the Transform Project. With the US, you know, we have seen some parallels, you know, since sort of 2015 with US politics, you know, Bernie being, you know, the analogy to Jeremy Corbyn. And, you know, I know just certainly, you know, just from social media, I know that, you know, leftists in the US are having a similar sort of debate now about how to strategize vis-a-vis the Democratic Party. And we've seen the emergence of, you know, Cornel West, you know, with his Green Party bid, and lots of the sort of debates around strategy and about whether it's better at the end of the day to just simply vote for the least worst option, you know, the Democratic or Labour option. Those sort of debates are being had in a US context as well. On both sides of the Atlantic, I favour the insurgent option, you know, the one which really, as you put it, puts some clear blue water between, you know, these established, supposedly left of centre parties, which are, you know, really neoliberal parties, and a more, you know, a sort of democratic movement to challenge that and provide an alternative.
Corbynism failed despite having all the resources of the Labour Party and all the benefits of the first past the post voting system that we have in Britain behind it. What are you hoping that you'll be able to achieve with a new left party that doesn't have that little head start that a lot of the same personalities and people with the same ideology had by virtue of, as you describe, accidentally taking over the Labour Party?
Well, it certainly won't be easy, James. I think there are different goals that you can talk about in the short to longer term. I think in the short term, there is a place for a disruptive force in British politics, a party that sort of regroups some elements of the left, which have become sort of disparate since the Corbyn project collapsed, and provides a place where left-wing ideas, left-wing policy, can be talked about and can have a place in the public discourse, can have a different style of politics, which provides an alternative, a more participatory alternative to the sort of managerialism that we'll see under Starmer, and which provides a sort of natural home for people who want a sort of participatory, democratic form of politics, which is very different to, I think, what we'll see under a Starmer government if one is elected. In the longer term, I think we have to be really ambitious, you know, and think big. You know, it sounds silly to say at this stage, you know, when we're just sort of putting out this call and talking on a podcast like this, but, you know, we have to think about building a party that can, you know, replace the Labour Party as the main party of opposition to the Tories. That's the sort of scale we have to be thinking on, but only because we have to think on a scale that matches the scale of the crises that we face. You know, we're forced to think in terms like this because of the scale of inequality, the scale of poverty, the scale of you know, the climate disaster that we're going to see.
I appreciate that you're describing a democratically participatory party, that democratically organized, and so you're not going to tell me what the agenda is. But the people who are building this or trying to build it, is the program that they're envisaging basically the 2017/2019 Labour manifestos. Is that what we're talking about here?
You're right to say that it's too early to say that. We're deliberately not putting out policy proposals because we want to form the party, give people an opportunity to join and have democratic rights as members to create policy. However, I would say that I think the 2017 and maybe to a lesser extent the 2019 Labour manifestos do continue to cast a long shadow over the left in Britain. And I think they're a good basis for discussions around policy because I think there's still, I think there's a broad consensus. People might have, certain disagreements with aspects of those manifestos, but I think they're a really good starting point for conversations about policy.
What about at the local level? Presumably the starting point for electoral activity with this project, apart from sort of getting a bit of attention and the odd by-election, is really local government. And of course, Preston and north of Tyne and Salford and other examples. We have instances of people pursuing what to me were the most interesting parts of the domestic agenda of Corbynism already, in the form of the what's been called the Preston model sometimes, community wealth building at other times, using the budget, the significant spending power of local government to incentivize cooperative local businesses, incentivize a kind of turn away from outsourcing to big internationals, and instead motivating local people to start small businesses that pay a living wage, have good green credentials, all the rest of it. We've already sort of seen the fact that even in the worst kind of Tory government, you can be doing that at a local level, as long as Keir Starmer doesn't then kick you out of the party. So it strikes me that however ambitious we all want to be and however much nostalgia we look back at our copies of the 2017 and 2019 manifestos, there is a kind of a way in which we could be quite specific about policies that we could actually do before ever reaching Westminster. Is that part of the discussion, a kind of focus on the local and on local government and on the things that are already being achieved in local government?
There is lots of talk of local action. I mean, one of the constituent parties of Transform is Liverpool Community Independence. Liverpool Community Independence are a group of councillors in Liverpool, many or all of whom were Labour councillors, and are now part of this new Left of Labour grouping. And they've had some electoral success where they haven't won local contests. They've come a strong second. And the reason they're able to do that is because, you know, they're the real deal in terms of a local community-based presence. You know, it's obvious that they care deeply about their community. They're out there, you know, responding to people's concerns every day. And this sort of thing has to be replicated up and down the country. You know, you mentioned community wealth building. I think those experiments are fascinating. Again, I can't anticipate what Transform policy might look like, but you know, it's not controversial to say I'm sure many people who would join that party would be really interested in those experiments, trying to push back against all the trends of outsourcing that we've seen over the last few decades. I think there's a lot you can do at the level of local democracy. It's a good way for people to get involved and start to feel empowered by just understanding how policy works at a local level and challenging their local representatives, many of whom are pretty useless, you know, and that's not even to do with party affiliation. You know, many local councillors up and down the country are just not good enough. Mm-hmm. In my day job, I do community organising and housing activism in Harrow in Northwest London. And, you know, we see the failings of local government on a day-to-day basis. So it's really important to get organized on a local level. And I think there's a space for a political party that does that in an effective way. You know, I don't, even at the sort of peak of the Corbyn years, the Labour Party was just starting to experiment with that. You know, they hired professional community organizers, who worked for the party. And, you know, I was a Labour member, you know, I attended some of those training sessions. It was eye-opening. You know, it felt empowering. It felt like a whole new way of conceiving of your political agency and your relationship to your community. Obviously, that was kind of a brief experiment. That's been shut down. I mean, they've lost their jobs, those community organizers. So again, you know, the space is open for a party to do something like that, which really empowers people. Even when you don't, you know, have control, over, so you don't have your hands on the levers of state power.
Paolo Gabaldo, author and academic, speaks of digital parties and stresses the importance of the digital dimension to organizing in a lot of the experiments across the political spectrum in creating these kinds of insurgency in the past decade. There's obviously there's going to be a big digital element to creating this this base for a project like Transform, just as Momentum and Corbynism itself to some extent really benefited initially from the fact that it had this kind of shortcut to gathering this huge mass of previously demobilized and often apolitical people. Gabaldo says that, however, quite a common factor in the success of these new kinds of parties that have been very dependent on digital media in order to form themselves is that they have a kind of charismatic figure or leader figure to cling on to. There's almost a tension between these very participatory and often anonymous mass formations online and this very kind of traditional form of politics of focusing on a particular leader. It strikes me that one of the best things that could happen to a project like this, other than doing the hard graft of getting a base in local government across the country, would be to have such a kind of celebrated case of an individual who's been kicked out of the Labour Party or excluded by the Labour Party and comes over to you guys. I mean, I'm watching Jamie Driscoll's campaign as an independent, as the Metro Mayor for the North of Tyne. He was the Labour Mayor and Keir Starmer and his administration have prevented him from running as the Labour candidate. And then, of course, we've got Jeremy himself and Diane Abbott, both of them celebrity figures. Even Diane Abbott was always on TV long before Corbynism. Corbyn, this extraordinary case of a former party leader who's now not even allowed to run as an MP for the Labour Party. Each of these are kind of cases about which there's a lot of public curiosity. I have no idea if Jeremy and Diane will run as independents in the end. Maybe finally they're just too loyal to the Labour Party to do it. You might know better than I do. As much as I completely agree and believe in the hard graft of community organising and the importance of creating a real activated working class base before thinking that you're going to have any durable success at the level of the state, it's got to be irresistible to be looking at these instances of really popular people, really effectual people in Driscoll's case, who are not with Labour anymore. And, you know, could you get them? Is that part of the conversation that you guys are having?
We would love for household names to sign up to this project and be part of it. I'd say at the moment, the steering committee that's running the Transform project is made up of names, made up of people who are respected within the movement. But, you know, they're not sort of left celebrities. They're not household names. Of course, that can be an advantage as well as a weakness, because there's no shortcut. You know, if Jeremy were to join the project tomorrow, even if Jamie Driscoll were to join, inevitably it would be seen in the short term by the media, by other people, as, you know, the Jeremy Corbyn show, the Jamie Driscoll show.
Yeah.
That has risks, you know, because then you just follow the figurehead and you think that you can use that to just generate a sort of instant overnight massive base of support online. And, you know, you maybe miss out on doing what you call, you know, the hard graft of building the community. So I don't think the success of this project in the short term depends on one of those sort of household name left figures joining. Of course, you know, we would love to work with, you know, all these people who we respect on the left.
One last question about this sort of organization side before we maybe dive a bit into the what the base for a project like this might be and what tensions that might present. What's wrong with the Green Party? There are ex-Corbynisters who are saying that that's the way to go. Entryism into the Greens, or supporting the parts of the Green Party that actually do have quite a lot in common with us. There's already a party of the left there, they would say. We don't need another one.
The Green Party occupies quite a curious place in the British political landscape, I think. They're obviously progressive enough to have some very decent policies and to attract some really good people. However, they're centrist enough that when things get tough, they've been, in my opinion, quite useless. My whole political formation really, you know, was the Corbyn years. And that was a sort of one-off historical shot at, you know, the left sort of taking control of the state. And, you know, where were the Greens during those years? The impression I got was that whenever the establishment sort of ganged up on Corbyn, they were quite happy to sort of go along with some of those points. They sort of rebranded themselves as a Remain party. I think they thought loyalty to a neoliberal trade bloc was more important than, you know, supporting this sort of class politics project. And I think that's not surprising when you understand that the Green Party is fundamentally not a party that's based on class politics. You know, the leaders, I understand, have said so themselves quite recently. You know, they don't sort of think of society or think of Britain's problems in terms of social class. And there needs to be a party for that, because,
yeah,
you know, that's what's missing. I think there are really good people involved in the Greens. We haven't talked a lot, you know, in Transform yet about whether we want to sort of, you know, collaborate with them in some sort of way, or what that might look like on the ground. But for whatever reason, I don't think they're rising to the historical moment in the way that we need and still exists for a sort of insurgent left party.
Yeah, I mean, seeing them participating in a Remain alliance, often against the party that actually had the Green New Deal, the first such party to be offering that in an election, seeing that should have done for the Greens as far as the left is concerned. For me, what that proved is that if you have a so-called radical party that doesn't declare itself as aspiring to be the party of class politics and the party of the working class, then it's not the other thing that they say they're concerned with that takes priority. It's a politics of the upper middle class that will take priority. They say, oh, we're not a class party, we're an environmental party. No, that means you're a party of the upper middle class, as it proved in that choosing Europe over the environment, over socialism, over the left back in 2019. So yes, I'd agree with that. I mean, this might be a way into speaking about the people that you're hoping to work with and attract. I gave that 40% figure for the 2017 election. That's kind of the ceiling for what a radical socialist party can achieve in Britain. It's much higher than anybody had ever thought before, and it's much higher than the vast majority of people are willing to remember or willing to have recorded and repeated. Now, 40% is the ceiling. We had 500,000 members in the Labour Party under Corbyn, much reduced now. So there is a big cohort of people out there. At the same time, the fact that half of the people in the Labour Party who had voted for Jeremy Corbyn then voted for Keir Starmer rather than Rebecca Long-Bailey, the chosen successor, this should give us quite a lot of pause, I think. That, for me, was the real defeat. It wasn't election night in 2019. I felt, well, there are so many local, historically specific impediments in this election. It's not that surprising. And hopefully my comrades have learned their lesson on Brexit and we can still move forward. The real defeat was the second one, which was realizing just how apolitical, really, those, half of those Corbyn supporters were. They realizing that it wasn't so much the program they were there for, it was wanting the nicest man in any situation. And Keir Starmer seemed to them to be the nicest man, despite the complete difference of relationship to the state, relationship to class politics, et cetera, that he represented. So I don't know, it's kind of ambiguous who it is out there who we are trying to, coalesce once again when we think in terms of saying, those Corbyn supporters have got nowhere to go. We need to give them something. So I guess I'm curious about who you think the Corbyn supporters are, who you think the left that should be supporting Transform UK is now, Transform Politics is now. After all, we've had a bit of generational churn. It's always very striking to me talking to young people that a lot of them, almost don't really remember who John McDonnell is or don't really remember so many of the things that were our constant obsessive bread and butter through those Corbyn years. So, yeah, who are you trying to appeal to? Who should be supporting this? And what constituency in Britain is it that you think we can get back together?
I think there's a need to create a party that speaks to a huge number of people who feel locked out of power, feel disempowered, who feel like their lives are getting worse, not better. In the short term, I think a political project like this, you can start with the low-hanging fruit, which is, people who are very politically conscious, who might describe themselves as socialists or on the left or anything like that. The groups that are almost the sort of archetypal Corbynites, which might be the sort of very online millennial generation, and the older generation. I think there were two generations that made up the bulk of Corbynites. And beyond that, again, it's the wider working class and people who are affected by the material crises that are affecting people in society. We're talking about the housing crisis, cost of living crisis, people who are affected by racism, people who are concerned about the climate crisis. These are massive groups of people. Of course, you have to think of, it's going to be hard to reach all of them. But again, there's such a gap right now between the reality for ordinary people, what they're suffering, what they need in order to survive, the gap between that and what the crumbs they're being offered by the political class, and speaking to that, trying to reach the people who are actually being affected by those material issues, I think has to be the way to go.
Quite a lot of them will already dislike Keir Starmer, and they would do so sometimes for reasons that you and your allies can agree with, and sometimes for reasons that you won't agree with. Some among them will still associate him with trying to block Brexit and will think that he's going to try to get Britain back into the EU by the back door, which may well be true. Others will think that he is woke, and others will think that he is part of some kind of anti-car environmental extremism and so on. You know, I guess a lot of your friends are part of an anti-car environmental extremism and pretty woke as well, and so might find it laughable that Keir Starmer is perceived that way. But you see where I'm going, that there is an anti-Starmer position out there and constituency out there. A lot of them are working class. A lot of them are, you know, lower petty bourgeois, tradespeople, etc. And they'll be getting their own idiom and their own kind of way of talking about what they don't like about him. And I don't know, is there a plan for that? Is there a way of breaking bread with these people, even though they maybe will view ex-Corbynistas with a certain amount of suspicion? I don't know. Is there any sort of sense in which the people you're working with are thinking it was a disaster that we were knocking on doors in the Corbyn years saying, look at all these great policies from Corbyn that are going to help you and empower you? And the reply was, yeah, but he's a London lovey. He doesn't want to do Brexit and all the rest of it. Is there any way that we can try to get ahead of that and see that if we're anti-Starmer, there are other people who are anti-Starmer, but they've got quite different ways of articulating what they don't like about him?
I think what you're really talking about here is sort of political narratives and how they're shaped by the mainstream media and more fringe media narratives that might distract people from what, you know, you and I think are sort of more pressing real crises. This is a massive challenge for the left, obviously. How to overcome some of these narratives? I think there's two aspects. One, we've got to build independent left media, which is what people like you are doing. And two, we've got to be present in communities, you know, and actually know our neighbours and be talking to them and have physical spaces where we can be talking about the day-to-day issues that affect people. Once you do that, in my experience, you know, when you do the community work, the real issues do surface. You know, people, you can't get away, despite what people may be saying online about, I don't know, 15-minute cities and, you know, all these slightly sort of weird issues that we think are distracting people. You know, you can't get away from the fact that there's a housing crisis. You can't get away from the fact that people can't afford childcare. If you have a consistent presence in working class communities, these issues will surface.
Yeah, I'd strongly agree with that. And actually, I think it works both ways. I think, you know, for all that I was talking about the dilemma of digital parties, the more undigital we can train ourselves to be, the better. Yes, it allows the left to not just be this kind of oddity that is read about secondhand in newspapers or in the media, or is seen behaving oddly online, and becomes something where, you know, the left is actually present in your community and is trying to work towards the good and trying to empower people locally. And it also works in the other direction, as you must have seen yourself, when people get involved in local organizing and in IRL political organizations, a lot of those certainties of people whose politics has been very online sort of melt away. I think that so many of the problems that we had in the Corbyn years and since of, let me just take Brexit, for example, or to be fair, all the stuff we were saying about the Greens applied to quite a lot of people on our side as well. They wanted to be a Remain party also. Well, if they spent a little bit more time as you're describing, in communities and among people who didn't think exactly the same as them, they might have started to kind of reconsider some of those certainties. So I think there's a kind of there's a mutual thing. It's not just we clever people on the left going out and doing the right thing and showing people that it's the right thing. It's that the left space itself needs to be retrained and corrected. Political education isn't just about leftists convincing people to be left-wing. It's about leftists having their own certainties qualified and retrained and repurposed by actually working among working class communities. I think that really, well, this podcast has always had a big emphasis on that being a major challenge to the left, that across the West today, projects like yours, projects I've been involved in too, have as their base a kind of downwardly mobile graduate cohort, what Dan Evans calls the new petty bourgeoisie. And these people are you know, the whole kind of resurgence of Marxism and socialism and left politics in recent decades couldn't have happened without this curious, educated, motivated cohort who really do not see any way in which they have been bought in by capitalism. That is a good starting point. That is a good core to have. Unfortunately, it comes with its own pathologies. It comes with a kind of suspicion of older people who they perceive as having done better out of the settlement. It comes with a kind of a sort of anti-populism, a suspicion of people who fall outside our own kind of cohort or our own kind of movement. And that has articulated itself in some real wrong moves. And Brexit was the failure to honour Brexit was probably the most kind of, you know, charismatic grand example of that. So, I guess I'm just saying something I'd like to see from a project like this, which is an awareness that we are certainly better than Starmer, and we don't want to be mistaken for Starmer, as is going to happen if we just leave it to the Labour left to speak for us. They're not going to help us. They're not going to save us. At the same time, we maybe could do with some introspection and some sort of house cleaning, as it were, with respect to the mistakes that the very class character of our movement has sometimes led us into.
Yeah, I think you have this curious phenomenon where people's whole political identity exists exclusively of just having certain political views and articulating those views online. You also have to join democratic organizations. As soon as you do that and start working through, you know, the messy process of IRL democracy and speaking to people, because you're trying to not just recruit them, but really find out about their lives and find out about their issues, the sorts of petty tribalism that you might have in your online political identity hopefully will be challenged. I think a good start is just really liking people. Yeah. It sounds like a slightly silly, sentimental thing to say, but you know, I think it's really important to be curious about people and to treat them as equals and not just as people you're trying to sort of convert to your cause.
So for me, the conundrum is, on the one hand, I think it's crucially important to be focused on the local. I think it's local issues where we have the potential for coalition building, and we also have the motivation and the promise of the fact that we could actually be introducing these policies very quickly. We don't have to wait for Westminster on them. At the same time, I think that there are much bigger national and, in fact, international issues that are affecting people's lives, that people do have quite strong and polarized, increasingly, opinions on, that the left has either not been clear or haven't really liked the side that it's taken. If we think of what the left has done in the UK since Corbynism, since the fall of Corbyn. I would look to COVID, and I'm not going to necessarily ask you to commit to positions on this. And after all, you're not going to have a COVID policy, one hopes, or you're not going to need one hopes. But where were we on that? Well, you look at what Navarra Media were doing, and they were basically the voice in the UK for the argument for the most extreme kinds of lockdown. Where are we on the Ukraine war? Well, obviously, in the sort of hodgepodge of people who are critical of NATO and critical of the role that Britain and its allies have had and are having in the region, of course, that includes some familiar faces from the anti-imperialist left. But by and large, when you look at Andrew Fisher last week, you look at Ian Lavery last week, you look at the Unite vote to continue arming Ukraine, I feel like the left has taken a quite sort of conservative stance on that as well, that there's a much greater diversity of opinion on these things out there in the country. So I guess what I'm saying is, as much as I'd almost prefer it if we had a new left party that only had local government policies and actually said, we're not even going to talk about the rest of it. We're not even going to talk about foreign policy. We're not even going to talk about national policies. At the same time, one of the things that I guess we've been covering on this show and that I've been trying to cover a bit in writing is that I feel like we've kind of lost our way in terms of being actually able to debate among ourselves some of the real most important issues that are facing the country. That might be a sort of bigger claim or statement than you personally want to react to, but I just wanted to kind of throw it out to you.
Well, on these issues that you've mentioned, you know, which is some of the most charged, divisive, controversial issues of our time, it is the case that people with sort of minority views or views that challenge the establishment view will be, you know, even among the left, sort of isolated as cranks, you know, which is probably not a very helpful word. One thing we've talked about in the Transform project, you know, the sort of interim steering committee, is the possibility of creating a party that has a sort of internal culture which will permit a really lively democratic debate. I hope it can be a space where even these really thorny subjects can be debated in a sort of expansive and comradely way without people writing off whole sections of their comrades as cranks or fascists or whatever it might be. That's going to be really hard. The whole tone of online debate is against us.
Yep.
It's amazing how the tone changes in real life, though. I find it incredible. You know, if you just go to a sort of left-wing book club or whatever, or, you know, any kind of in-person meeting, people simply don't chuck around the kind of insults they do online. It's just not possible. It's just not socially possible. You know, you get punched in the face. You can't do it. And so people are forced to have a more constructive, respectable conversation. So we've got to create those spaces locally, if possible, on a national level as well, where people can recognize the core similarities they have that bring them together into a shared organization while also having the courage to articulate differing views. That's good. That's really hard. I hope we're able to try to do that.
I think that that's very important. And the experience of the anti-Semitism affair does not give one a great deal of optimism in the first instance. This very quick kind of division between people who were completely committed to optics and wanted to deny that there was a substantive political issue at stake in it, versus people who in many cases became totally monomaniacal on the issue. I think that you're right that a huge amount of help would be given to not doing it online, and to saying that part of the party culture here is that we do not air our laundry in front of everybody, and we do not denounce and subtweet each other and think that that is a meaningful political discourse. All that that is the party producing this kind of virtually permanent record to be scoured over by our enemies, and that is exactly what happened, and that was really the material core of the anti-Semitism affair. So much of this stuff just being produced willingly online for our enemies to selectively quote and scour over. So yeah, I think that that's helpful, and there is a sort of there's a theme in your answers here, which is the theme that actually people are a lot more thoughtful and decent than it's possible to end up giving them credit for when your experience of politics has been tumbling from one crisis to another and one disappointment to another, and that the aspiration should be towards discussing these and every issue in a way that you'd be happy to talk about it in the school gate or with your colleagues at work or in the pub or Costa or whatever, that that's that kind of populism. The assumption that we can have a decent conversation with people and not assume that they're either irrecoverable reactionaries or that they're not gonna, we have to simplify our issues because no one could possibly understand such complicated geopolitical things as we're interested in.
Yeah, I mean, you shouldn't patronize people and simplify, to a massive extent. Similarly, you obviously shouldn't go around using deliberately obscure academic language. Yeah, there's a really healthy middle point, and we should become really used to speaking that way.
Yeah. Well, as you can tell from the questions, I have my doubts, and presumably you have your doubts as well. It's a mountain to climb, and we got a sort of, we accidentally got a taste of being a much more powerful force than we really were during the Corbyn years, and maybe we should be grateful that that gave us a taste and a snapshot of just how challenging it is keeping a coalition together, and just how challenging it is when your political formation represents a genuine threat to the entrenched interests of the state. But there was too much good in it, and there's too much good in the processes and the people and the policies for us to happily just let go of all that. And so I strongly welcome this idea of a new party potentially called Transform Politics. Apart from anything else, what I said before about the absolute necessity of, if we're going to have a left, it has to be substantially different to what's happening in Keir Starmer's Labour Party. And people need to know that we're different to what's happening in Keir Starmer's Labour Party.
It has to be the opposite. It has to be participatory instead of managerial, democratic instead of anti-democratic, hopeful instead of cynical. It has to be anti-Starmerism.
Anti-Starmerism. It starts here. Jackson Keynes, thank you very much on behalf of Transform Politics for coming onto the Popular Show.
Thank you, James. It's been a pleasure.